Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Earlier this week, the Tulsa Historical Society released a new computer app that provides viewers with all of the museum's holdings on the subject visitors and researchers most want to know about, the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. The app features photographs, newspaper clippings, documents, as well as photographs of artifacts relating to the riot, which is available to researchers, educators, students, as well as anyone with an interest in this tragic event. The app is part of a greater effort by the Society to fully tell the story of the city's history, from the finest moments in Tulsa history to its worst, from the stories of success and privilege to the stories of survival and privation that shaped the city as it is today. Joining us today are the Executive Director of the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum, Michelle Place, along with the Archivist and Curator of Collections, Ian Swart. They're here to tell us about the new app, why they released it, about other apps that are coming about Tulsa history, as well as this greater effort to connect the whole city to the work of the Historical Society. Michelle and Ian, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Tulsa Historical Society has just introduced a new app. What's interesting about it is you're really starting to change the way people view your museum in the fact that it's not just come to the museum, but you're really bringing the museum to the people. Tell us a bit about how this app for the Tulsa Race Riot came about.
Well, about a year ago, several of our past board presidents and all of our staff met to decide upon a long-range plan. And out of that came three initiatives. The first was that we would be seen as a respected research repository. Our second initiative is to bring more technology, as you said, into the museum, particularly with historical societies. If you don't add that technology, then you're sort of seen as a place where there might just be old, rusty tools or home items, and we're much more than that. Our third initiative was that we would be committed to education. The number one question that the Tulsa Historical Society is asked, and it easily comes three times a week, and the questions literally come from all over the globe, and we are asked about the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot. So if we know that that is the question that we are asked the most often, and then we want to bring this technology component and be able to make our research available, and then we also have this education initiative, it's very logical that we would proceed to make our archives available. What we've done is say to the community, through this app that's available through iPad, through the Apple App Store, here is everything that the Tulsa Historical Society knows. Every photograph, every clipping, every article is available to the public. We are hiding nothing. We are holding nothing back. So we've made it available through this app. It's $9.99 through the Apple App Store. And we also have a foundation who will underwrite the cost of any educator or any educational institution who would like to have this app for free.
So I'm assuming, is that the target audience, like for educators for the most part, or people, is this actually going to be a more of a research app for people who are wanting to write about the race riot, or what exactly, Ian?
Those calls each week that come in about the riot are from documentarians, graduate students who are writing dissertations. We get calls from authors, from teachers who are looking for resources to teach the riot in the classroom. So it's really a variety of different people who are, we hope, will be using this tool.
Now, Michelle said that every artifact that you have about the race riot is included on the app. Now, I remember what the state of the archives of the Historical Society was a few years ago. I know you've been busy working on that, but how many items total is that?
Right now, there are over 600 individual items, and this isn't going to be a stagnant archive. Once things come into the museum or additional things that are donated, those will be continually added to this digital archive, and things will continually be updated and new connections made. It's not just a tool where you can pull up photos and just look at them as, you know, individual objects. You know, there's the saying that no man lives in a vacuum, and these items all are related. And so this tool gives the user a brand new way to look at these items and to see how they're related. it's all kind of behind the scenes. You don't really see how it works. But when you pull up an item, you can see the other items within the archive that they're related to.
So there's a high degree of interconnectivity.
Yes. So if it's a person that you're researching, you can look, pull up the person, read a biography, and learn more about that person's life. And it may throw you into a newspaper article that that person is mentioned in. It may be a photograph, but you can even search and see, you know, what their hometown was, what their occupation was, what businesses they might have owned, those sorts of things. Those connections are made.
Is the Historical Society actively seeking more race riot material at this point?
Wholeheartedly, yes. Yes. And this app, when word got out that we were working on this, additional things have come in. You know, people are cleaning out closets or that sort of thing. So you never know when you pick up the phone who's going to be on the other end and what treasures they're going to have.
Now, you mentioned newspaper clippings as well as photographs, but are there actual artifacts related to this?
There are. Those would be documents that are found within the collection, including diary entries, personal correspondence that was written the day of or in the days after, and passes that were used. People had to have passes to travel throughout the city.
Right.
And if you were one of the victims who was rounded up and sent to the different camps around town, you had to have identification showing where your place of employment was so that you could travel to work for a family or whatnot. You had to be able to prove who you were and what business you had.
Right. That was a dark chapter.
Yes,
yeah. ID, basically,
yes.
Papers like you would expect in,
yes.
in a more totalitarian society.
Yes.
So, well, all those things are up on the app at this point, right?
Yes, sir. Yes,
sir. All right. We talked about the technology aspect of it. Is this something that the museum is systematically embarking on as far as I know how you're actually showing this material in the museum is kind of interesting because I would imagine if people are coming to the museum from out of town, they probably, if they know anything about the race riot, they would always want to see an exhibit on that. And of course, that's probably not practical for the museum. So you've actually created an electronic space where all this material's viewable at the museum as well, right?
Yes, we call it a virtual exhibit about the 1921 race riot. As soon as you walk in the door, right next to our greeter desk, is a large television screen so that you can see in a larger format if there were other people standing around they also could observe. But just in front of that is a kiosk with an iPad that you operate just like your iPad in your own home, wherever it is with all of the slide functions that mm-hmm. are on it.
Is this going to be an ongoing project for other parts of the city's history as far as making an electronic exhibit?
Yes.
In addition to, say, your artifact-heavy exhibits that yes. would fill the galleries?
We have already committed. I'm often asked, okay, if the race riot is the first question that you're asked, what's number two? I generally laugh and say, well, it's... Can you give me the history of my home? The short answer is no, we can't. But followed by that, we are most often asked about Tulsa's art or particularly our Art Deco architecture. So we have already committed to produce another app about the art of Tulsa and also Tulsa's Art Deco architecture. Those two items will in many times coincide, but we'll find a wide range of Tulsa's art and Art Deco. We're really looking forward to having that available the end of the first quarter.
Of 2015,
mm-hmm. right. This software is designed by a local computer software engineer. His name is Daniel Mooney, and his company is MooMat. They also have this same software at the Sherwin Miller Museum. In fact, that's where we first learned about it was through Drew Diamond, and they use a part of their collection that has to do with the Holocaust. And so that was where we were first wowed by this software application and then have brought it to fruition for the race riot and look forward to talking about Tulsa's art and Art Deco.
Do you anticipate this will be sort of a end-all stop for research scholars that are wanting more information on the riot, or is it more of a stepping stone to saying, okay, this is what the Historical Society has. Now I'm going to come visit and actually look at the articles. How do you expect that to work?
I think it could be both things. You know, there's something very special about standing in front of an artifact. That's an experience that you just don't get when you're doing research online. But the fact of the matter is, in the 21st century, most people are doing research online. And so museums are sort of at a crossroads at this point. How do we showcase the items that we have in our collections online, but how do we also maintain visitors coming in? You know, we do want people to come in and we can share Tulsa's history with them, but we also want to be accessible to people. So I think that's the line right now. Yeah. And from a preservation standpoint, it would not be good to have all of these items on display all of the time. So this gives us the unprecedented opportunity to have these items accessible to patrons.
And I think the idea of having a kiosk at the museum, because as you mentioned, you're always asked about the race riot. You can't always have an exhibit up, and it's not great for the objects themselves if they're fragile to have them on view all the time. But you have sort of a permanent installation, but it's an electronic permanent installation.
Right. It's particularly for the preservation. Imagine all of these graduate students across the country who are writing master's thesis or dissertations. And if they needed to purchase a plane ticket or travel expenses to Tulsa, they would have to make an appointment with Ian to sit down and look at the collection. Well, not only does that take up his time, they're also incurring all of those expenses. But each time those photographs or documents are handled, they're subject to deterioration. So it's also very important for preservation that we have instilled this.
Do you expect classroom teachers, people teaching Oklahoma history, to utilize this app? Do you think that's going to be a reaction? Have you heard from classroom teachers yet?
Less than 2 weeks ago, a young girl from Union came in on a Saturday morning with her parents, and she had an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper with her instructions for a classroom homework piece. And she was to visit the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum, and she was to view the Greenwood exhibit that is currently being exhibited. And she was also supposed to take a look at this app and to find 5 artifacts that were included and 5 pieces that struck her, and she was to write a 1-page narrative about her findings. So as someone on staff at the museum, I was very excited to find that this tool is being used by teachers.
Already being before it's officially launched.
Yes.
That is a great way to use it. And you also mentioned the other exhibit that's up, because in addition to this electronic exhibit, you have an exhibit which shows the other side of Greenwood, which is
exactly.
The prosperity of that district even before and after the race riot, the rebirth.
That was very important to us. And in fact, I have a number of people within the Tulsa community who are surprised or maybe not as pleased that we're talking about the 1921 race riot.
It's still a very sensitive subject.
It is. And we certainly have taken that into account and tried to deal with it in a very sensitive way. So it was important to the staff that once we launched this app and made everything available about this very horrific event, that we also launch an exhibit about the spirit of Greenwood. Yes, this was a horrible event, but we need to look back at this time and say, what are those lessons that we can learn? Where are both the good lessons and the bad lessons? We're not making this app available to third graders. There are horrific, horrific photographs in there. The story is horrific. But out of this, we can talk to third graders about relationships with people who are different than you are. What is it about the human condition? What was the same? What was different? We look at, could this situation happen again? What happens if we don't get to know someone who's different from us? How far have we come? So from a younger perspective, that's what we'll be looking at, is cross cultures and cross relationships, and not really delving into the exact really horrific photographs. I keep using that word horrific, but I have no other word.
Yeah. My guest today is Michelle Place, the executive director of the Tulsa Historical Society, along with Ian Swart, who is the archivist and curator of collections. The Historical Society has just released an app to the public for researchers, for educators, for people who just are always asking questions of the Historical Society about the 1921 Tulsa race riot. It's the first in a series of historical apps that the Society is going to come up with. It came out to the public on Sunday. And the next one will be on our Art Deco heritage, which will be in the first part of 2015. And they're our guests today on Studio Tulsa. Well, getting back to the Greenwood exhibit, which is looking at the prosperity and the spirit of that neighborhood over the years, another changing focus of the Historical Society is, historically speaking, the Historical Society has tended to focus on the power brokers, the people who helped settle the city, the oil men who built the city. And one of the things you were telling me is that's happening is the Historical Society is really trying to tell the story of all Tulsa. And that means the story of North Tulsa, increasingly today, the story of East Tulsa and its Hispanic influence. I would think probably the story of West Tulsa and the oil field workers that lived in that particular part, the blue collar people, as well as the white collar. Can you talk about that initiative?
Exactly. This is a major initiative, particularly with our full museum staff now. We are committed to doing this. The sole reason that Tulsa exists is because of the cattle industry. Most people think we started with oil. That's not true. It started even before the Trail of Tears. We have a great collaboration with the Creek Nation. We own the Perryman Cemetery at 32nd and Utica, and we have partnered with the Daughters of the American Revolution to restore that cemetery. We've added lots of monuments to unmarked graves. It was a great initiative that Ian Swart headed up with Rita Sharinsky from a local DAR chapter. So we have partnered with the Creek Nation. We want to tell their story. We'll be doing an exhibit in collaboration with them. But then next came that cattle industry. That's the sole reason that the railroad is extended all the way to the Arkansas River. Well, all this cattle came up from South Texas and Mexico. Who were those cowboys? They were Hispanic. So we want to tell those stories. Who built the railroad? Well, we know the Transcontinental Railroad, while it was being built, so many of those laborers were Asian. What about Asians in Tulsa? Immigration is nothing new. It's been with us for a long time. Then we want to focus on our African American culture. What brought them to Indian Territory? What was it about them leaving what they had known, their existence in the eastern United States, and manifest destiny, searching out a place to live in prosperity and in peace? So we want to tell all of those stories, not just the roughneck and the roustabout and the old man, but all of these other stories.
Mm. Now, earlier, your first initiative regarded making the Historical Society a larger part of a research repository for the community and for scholars. Ian, I assume that's your bailiwick.
Yes.
So what's going on with the collection as far as making it a place of research?
Every week, I am the host to different researchers coming in. We have really focused on inputting artifacts into a searchable database.
And that's been an ongoing issue because nobody had been doing that for years, right?
Right. And so, 10 years ago, museums were still working with, card catalog systems like you would have seen at a library. And so it's a massive undertaking to take this collection of potentially hundreds of thousands of individual pieces and putting them into a database. But that includes writing full descriptions, measuring, writing a condition report.
Are you running across objects in which maybe the history of the object is a little less known than it was at one point?
Yes, and finding pieces. We've been collecting for 50 years, and every museum will have items in their collection that they have no idea where it came from. So we're still making discoveries within our archives, including a large collection of photographs that had been taken by Thomas Gilcrease during his travels in the 20s in the Mediterranean and in Southern Europe. And so last year we had a large exhibit showing these photographs. And the very neat thing was that on the back of these prints were ink notations where Mr. Gilcrease himself had written what his thoughts were. And David Randolph Milston, Gilcrease's biographer, in his 1969 biography of Mr. Gilcrease, said that he wished that he knew what Mr. Gilcrease had been thinking on these trips about what he saw for himself. So lo and behold, here's this missing piece this very important piece that really shaped Mr. Gilchrist's life and made him really want to increase his collecting efforts.
Yeah, shaped him as a collector.
Yes,
yeah.
To collect American history. So we're still making discoveries.
That sounds great. You were talking about technology. And a lot of times when you go to a, quote, city museum in various cities, there's a lot of dust. There's a lot of things, you know, pinned on bulletin boards, and it's exhibits that are pretty static and haven't changed for a long time. One of the things I've noticed about the Historical Society is you're really trying to create really interactive exhibits that really capture people's attention, and I assume that's an ongoing effort of the Society.
Definitely. We have 8 rotating galleries. Something is changing every month. Our largest exhibit currently is on Tulsa in the 1930s. So we debunked that myth about the Dust Bowl being in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That was farther west, but we'll show you on a map where it was. But we also want to tell you what was going on in the 30s. That exhibit runs through the 1st of February, and then we'll be changing it out. The next one will be about Tulsa in the 1950s. That should bring back lots of memories for our Tulsa citizens. The other thing that we try very hard to do is to build trust with Tulsans. We want Tulsans to understand that the things that we're taking into our archives, we are taking full stewardship. We promise to take care of them to the very best of our ability into perpetuity. So we are definitely putting out a call. Don't throw anything away. Please call us first. You can reach us at 918-712-9484 and visit with our archivist, with Ian. And if we already have lots of copies of maybe a yearbook, but there are several years that we might be missing. So don't throw those things away. Please call us first. And We're ever expanding our collection.
All right. Well, how do people get the app? Is it just a search for it on the iTunes store or what exactly?
Yes, through your iPad. Mm-hmm. You can just go to the iTunes store, to the Tulsa Historical Society, and it will walk you through it. If there's any educator or educational institution, contact the Tulsa Historical Society, THS@TulsaHistory.org, and we'll walk you through the steps to make those available for any schools or educator who would like to have them.
All right. Well, Michelle and Ian, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Place is the Executive Director, Ian Swart, the Archivist and Curator of Collections for the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum, which is located at 2445 South Peoria. Their new Tulsa Race Riot app is available through the iTunes Store. For more information about that and the exhibits at the museum, visit TulsaHistory.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Now it's time for a Tulsa StoryCorps moment. The Airstream trailer may have left the Guthrie Green, but we'll continue to share the stories that were told there with you. Today, Shirley Elliott speaks with Steve Liggett, the Artistic Director of Living Arts, about the origins of that organization, Tulsa's budding relationship with contemporary art, and the woman who helped spearhead both. Virginia Myers.
Virginia Myers was one of the original artistic directors of Living Arts. So tell me about your first encounter with Virginia Myers.
Back in 1975, I transferred from the University of Oral Roberts. I was a clay student at the time. I was studying with Tom Manhart. And Tom said, you know, I want you all to go and see this interesting woman, Virginia Myers, who is doing a concert at this place in Tulsa. And I thought, this is the craziest thing. Why does a potter need to go and listen to a music concert? This is nuts. But I went because I respected him and got there, and everyone was seated, and I sat down, and Virginia came in and opened the piano and climbed inside the piano and started playing it from the inside. And, that was really super weird for me. You know, she was playing a George Crumb piece, and I had never experienced anything like that. But I had this background from Oral Roberts University, and I knew demons when I saw them. And I knew that this woman was demon-possessed. So I waited about 30 minutes into the thing, and I decided, okay, I just can't handle this anymore, and got up and left and went back to school the next day. And I said, Tom, why did you send us to this demon-possessed woman to listen. And he laughed and he said, well, you know, you might just hang out with that demon-possessed woman, Steve, because you might learn something. So that was my first encounter with Virginia Myers, a brilliant woman, a contemporary of John Cage, and studied at Eastman School of Music and started living arts really from what she learned there at Eastman. So I did. We had meditation groups, and I sat with her and learned a lot.
So in that first year, what was the location, and what, give us a picture of what living arts looks like?
The Canes Ballroom is a famous place in Tulsa. It was the home of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, and downhill from that was the Brick House Gallery, and John Ridgway was the person who had renovated one of the old buildings in Tulsa that were places that the roughnecks that were in the oil industry would have rooms while they worked in the oil fields. And the downstairs was perfect, and he'd moved in with his girlfriend, and the front was a small space for a gallery, I saw, and the middle area was a space for performance work, and then the back was a little apartment. So as my marriage fell apart, I moved in and started living arts into a new realm. We had never really had a permanent-ish type of home. And at the side of that building was an old burned-out space for, we called it the burnout space, that was for outdoor kind of experimental activities. And it was really perfect. It was a haven for people who really wanted to work with cross-disciplinary works of art as well as, you know, some wild stuff.
Can you give us an example of some of those early adventures you had there in performance?
Well, I remember one night we had Walt Costi.
A local Tulsan.
A local Tulsa poet, great guy. He performed his poetry out in the burnout space. He projected onto the back wall a swing, which then he was in the projection as a person swinging in that, and he did a dialogue with himself. But during that piece, then he climbed up onto the I-beam above and did a sort of a balancing act, crossing the beam, came down, started a fire in the area.
On purpose.
And many people left because they were they knew Walt well enough to know that it was going to get interesting. And this was pretty typical of, you know, it was like 1993, 94 in that time period. Everyone knew that this was a place where it was really happening. And I was lucky to be a part of it. I think that we've created like a little box for people to shake things up inside. You know, we can have a stable place that people can feel free and comfortable to be creative. And that's what I've always wanted to create.
Shirley Elliott speaking with the Artistic Director of Living Arts, Steve Liggett, about the beginnings of Tulsa's contemporary art movement, recorded at the StoryCorps booth at the Guthrie Green. While the StoryCorps booth has moved on to Dallas, we'll continue to share StoryCorps moments with you from their Tulsa visit. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.